Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. You know, if there's one issue that always comes up on Farm to Table Talk, it's trust. Trust is the biggest thing. We end up talking about issues. We end up talking about trust. When I go to meetings, I meet a lot of people who are talking about trust. And then I come back and I look at the business cards. And our guest today has an interesting business card. Right on the card itself, it says, "Trust Lives Here." And that really makes you think. It's a card that says Consumer Reports. And that makes you think, too, because a lot of people have come to rely on Consumer Reports and know they take a certain point of view. And we're fortunate today to have Dr. Urvashi Rangan. And Urvashi is leading and directing the Consumer Safety and Sustainability Group for Consumer Reports. Urvashi, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks so much, Roger.
I'm going to let you explain a little bit more of what your responsibilities are.
You know, let me start with a little bit about Consumer Reports. We're a nonprofit organization that started actually in 1936, and we're celebrating our 80th birthday this year. And since the inception of Consumer Reports, we've been an independent nonprofit group. We don't take any corporate money. We have very strict conflict of interest policies. I can't invest in any stocks of anything that we test as an organization, all in an effort to sort of really preserve our independence in terms of the information we're giving to consumers. And consumers are really our client and the ones we want to educate, and in the most honest way possible. So we're not vested in anything that we talk about. We don't stand to gain anything from any of the recommendations that we make. My own role here, I've been here for about 17 years, and I'm one of the senior scientists here. And while I run our safety and sustainability group, my own passion and expertise area is in the food area. I'm an environmental health scientist by training, somewhat like a toxicologist, and am often looking at those scientific connections between what we do in the environment and how that affects public health. And so much of what we do, it falls into that intersection. And food and agriculture really sit squarely in that as well. And so I've spent a lot of my time here evaluating food systems, doing a lot of food safety testing projects, like the safety of beef or chicken or heavy metals in different foods like mercury in fish or arsenic in rice, and also trying to really probe the market to see what are the better options for consumers. Are there production systems that are creating better choices for consumers, and how can we direct consumers to those choices?
Boy, that's a big task, and you kind of beat me to the punch. I was going to ask you what gets you excited and what you like best about your job, and the first thing you came out with was talking about your passion in the area of food.
It's true. I love food, and I love educating people on food. Contaminants are certainly a passion of mine across the board, and in other products as well. But I think, you know, just to answer that question squarely on my part, one of my favorite things to do is really to help deconstruct really difficult scientific information into information that anybody can understand, because I think it's so important that we as consumers have a good understanding of our choices out there and can make truly informed decisions. Because if we're making our purchasing decisions with the best information out there, that to me creates the underpinning for really making choices that will create long-term changes by shifting demand in a really honest and informed way in the marketplace.
Well, you have a magazine, you have a website, I think you testify, don't you, too, on issues
yes,
coming up and regulations and so forth. How do you decide what makes the lineup? Because you only, again, if you have 12 issues a year of the magazine, if you've got your website you're updating, you've got your blog and so forth, but, I mean, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of new products coming out all the time and consumer concerns. How do you prioritize and decide that something is worth your attention, that you're going to, you know, have it be an issue that you dig in and do more research on and look at all the angles on that will result in a story or testimony or something down the road?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And, you know, not to mention resources in terms of running these investigations, it costs a lot of money to, you know, our chicken project, for example, is somewhere on the order of just $250,000 in testing just to run 300 chicken samples through pathogen testing and antibiotic resistance testing. So we do choose carefully. We look at a couple of different things. We look at, one, you know, where are sort of problems happening in the food supply, for example, and we know that there are many, many acute foodborne illnesses every year. That happens from getting exposed to pathogens, mostly from raw meat. We also know that cross-contamination is a huge problem, and lots of people eat chicken, lots of people eat beef, lots of people eat shrimp, and lots of people eat rice. And so even when we're looking at heavy metals, for example, we were really interested in what foods were taking up the most arsenic out there, and rice goes to the top of the list. We look at government data, and we look to see where we see things peaking, and that's where we sort of picked up on the arsenic was from FDA's own data. We look at USDA's data on things like pesticide residues. We also look at antibiotic resistance data coming out of the government, and that helps guide us in terms of where the biggest problems lie. In terms of emerging hazards, we also look for things that haven't been explored enough, and arsenic in the food supply was definitely one of those. And there aren't any standards in place for food. Arsenic is something we regulate very heavily in water, but before we had started in launching our investigations, there were no standards for food, and people being exposed to such a potent carcinogen in the food supply was something that was of concern to us, and we wanted to start to have that public dialogue about chronic hazards in the food supply and how people could mitigate their exposures.
But, you know, heavy metals is something that really isn't popular. It isn't something that a lot of people are talking about, not like they have opinions on GMO labeling or
That's
other
right.
issues that have become popular. And I understand it, too. When you get into heavy metals, arsenic is one that you're looking at now, but there's cadmium and arsenic and lead and mercury. And,
yeah.
And I also, isn't it true that a lot of that comes from pollution for areas of the world where food products are imported, where the water supply is heavily polluted with heavy metals, that they're more likely in the fruits or vegetables that are irrigated from those heavy metals to pose a problem and be present in the end product that people consume?
That's definitely one major how a contaminant might spread through water, and heavy metals definitely can be spread through water. Mercury and coal fire power plants, for example, are hand in hand. And so electric plants that burn coal emit mercury into the air. We think that deposits in the ocean, and that's how mercury levels have sort of come to be in certain types of fish, especially really big fish, tuna, for example, swordfish. There's some other fish as well. And in that case, you know, we certainly, whether something comes from a naturally occurring source or was natural at one point or moves around through something natural, when people are exposed to that, it's still a risk, no matter where it came from. Arsenic is something that occurs naturally as well, and it's also found in water supplies, especially well water up in Maine and New Hampshire. Those levels can be quite high in arsenic. We want people to know about that. We want them to at least be testing their water and at least take steps to mitigate their exposure, even if it's sort of unavoidable, so to speak. There are things you can do to help at least mitigate what your exposure may be. But we also love to probe at not just the product and the issue, but in the case of arsenic in rice, for example, when we started to peel that onion, we learned a lot of things, and some of these we knew. But, for example, for decades we were feeding poultry arsenic, and we did it to pink their flesh and had a little bit of an antimicrobial activity as well. Certainly not something necessary, but we fed them arsenic all the time. And poultry eat whatever they eat and then excrete it into their manure. And then we take their manure and we fertilize crops with it. So that was one way we were concerned about how we ourselves were actually compounding arsenic in our food supply and spreading it. The other thing, that practice thankfully stopped as of last December. We and a number of other groups were finally effective in getting that practice stopped altogether. That said, we still spray cotton fields, sod farms, golf courses, and rights of ways with arsenic pesticides, and that will contaminate groundwater after a period of time. And that also continues to compound arsenic in our food supply. So doing silly things like that are things that we think we have control over and we should stop. And that's part of our mission in any test that we do, is to try to get at some of the larger issues around how that contaminant may be getting into that particular food supply and what we can do about that.
Well, I have to ask you a couple questions on that. I think, first of all, the reason that that's a concern, you mentioned that it's a carcinogen at certain levels. So is it, if people consume enough of it, are they more likely to develop cancer?
Yeah, that is right. And carcinogens in the food supply are, you know, as you pointed out, not a popular topic. People don't understand it very well. And it's something where making different decisions today matters. And so we're not trying to alarm people and say, if you ever ate rice before, you're going to get cancer. That's not really what this discussion is about. Carcinogens in the food supply are actually more about being exposed to generally lower levels than what would be acutely harmful of a contaminant over a long period of time. And that is the sort of modality for cancer-causing substances in anything, but in this case we're talking about food. So really, it's about thinking about the future and what you do with that, and mitigating or moderating your consumption of certain foods so that you can, in fact, reduce your exposure to these carcinogens.
Well, I think the other question that raises in my mind is, why is that left to you? I mean, the consumers' union. I mean, consumers, I think, have the hope that government agencies are checking all of these things, and that there are regulations that, and the companies are looking out to be cautious in production practices and manufacturing practices and so forth. And you mentioned there are some other groups too, in addition to, you know, Consumers Union and what you would put in Consumer Reports, that jump on the bandwagon. Why is that even necessary? Why does the trust that consumers have in the government that it will be taken care of, why doesn't it work to the extent people hope it does?
It's such an important question, and I think you've hit on something, which is that people assume that things that are on the market today have been demonstrated to be safe, and that's what our government requires. And in many ways, that is the charge to the Food and Drug Administration and to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, that our food has been determined to be safe, and practices that we use in production have been determined to be safe before we've actually put them into commerce. But the fact of the matter is, that's not the case. And we have something like 80,000 chemicals out on the market today. Most of them have not been fully tested for safety or efficacy, how well they work. And that's a problem. The food additive system for safety is called GRASS, or Generally Recognized as Safe. It's an entire system that, if you look at the regulations, falls under the purview of the Food and Drug Administration. You might even read the regulations and think, wow, they actually do determine that every food additive that's out there is safe, and they're keeping track of those things. It turns out the government has really offshored that responsibility largely to the industry. And so it is companies that can determine whether a new food ingredient or additive is safe. They don't even have to report it to the FDA. The FDA doesn't even keep track of those new ingredients, let alone dealing with problems that we determine are associated with certain food additives down the line after they have been in commerce. The system is completely broken down, and that's why groups like ours, Food and Water Watch, Center for Science and the Public Interest, Natural Resources Defense Council, these are just, you know, a few of the groups that spend a lot of their time and our time looking at these issues and trying to publicize this. At this point, we do want to hold the government accountable, and we spend a lot of our time doing that. As Consumer Reports, though, we have a magazine that obviously consumers buy, and so part of our mission is to give people the sort of empowerment to make decisions in the short term while we work on the government to make policy changes in the long term. And we think that two-pronged effect can be quite effective because consumers actually have the power to change demand by what they buy. And that change can happen very quickly, much more quickly than policy changes can happen. And often it is that demand that tips over the policy change. And so we really do try to leverage those two things. The other thing we do here are taking national survey polls of consumers, not just our subscribers, but national polls like the Gallup poll or anything else, and really try to understand what consumers want out of their purchases, what they think, for example, certain labels mean out there, where they're being misled. We're able to quantify that in some cases, and what they expect. And that kind of information can also be incredibly powerful, not only in letting consumers know what the general population thinks about something, but letting the government know that, hey, there is a demand for better production systems. And our surveys certainly show that there is a mandate from consumers for better production practices, for better living wages for people who make our food, for better conditions for animals that we are raising for food, for reduced pesticide use, for reduced pollution to the environment. All of those things are incredibly important to consumers. And by elevating that opinion, we think we're able to also leverage that to make better policy changes.
Well, I would imagine that you bring that kind of hard data to the corporate world, too, and remind them that their consumers want to buy products like that. I would imagine you've had some examples of where you change corporate behavior because it made a business case to them.
That's right. I think, you know, we don't sort of know, I think, even all the times when that might have occurred, but there are so many companies out there who are really trying to do the right thing, who want to do the right thing, and in some ways are validated sometimes by the stories that we come out with. And I can't tell you, I think one of the most gratifying things I do in my work here is when we are critical of an industry, say like the rice industry, or, well, let's take the rice industry, for example. We really, in some ways, called them out, and there wasn't that they were doing something illegal because there were no standards in place. They weren't adding arsenic to their food, but it was a concern that we wanted to raise. But we don't stop there, and we've met with the Rice Federation, which is the rice trade group. We've met with Lundberg Rices, which is a very progressive rice company out in California that's really trying to do more research and trying to learn about agricultural practices that affect the uptake of arsenic in rice. In a lot of cases with the investigations that we do, we're sparking something that maybe the industry didn't fully understand, it didn't know about, But what we've learned over time is that the really progressive players want to do something about it. There's another company called Nature's One that produces, of many things, a toddler infant formula. And when we were doing our arsenic testing, we became aware of the fact that they were working hard to reduce the amount of arsenic from brown rice syrup that they were using to sweeten some of those toddler formulas. And we documented it over time and showed that they were, in fact, getting to much, much lower levels, almost negligible levels of arsenic from their toddler infant formulas. And it just goes to show you that there really are some interesting companies out there who aren't afraid of the news and want to do a better job and really sort of get in there. They spend money on it. They spend research on it because they're interested in providing a truly better product.
Well, you know, one other thing it points out to me is that you're willing to meet at a table, to get people at the table, whether they're the farmers and their trade associations and councils and boards and the companies, too. It sounds like there's more dialogue taking place to make constructive changes than the public image, at least in years past, that the consumer movement opposed to big business, and big business thought that you were just anti-business. And it sounds like there's more progress made and sitting around the table and trying to figure out how to work on solutions together. Is that wishful thinking on my part, or is that the case?
No, I think that's right, and I think that that's a really important part of what we do. There is a line in there between making sure we are providing independent information, but then once we do provide that information, inviting anyone who wants to come and speak with us about it, responding in detail to people who complain to us, about their concerns with our findings or our investigations. We're very willing to have a debate about issues, to have a dialogue about those issues, and really we like to think of ourselves as sort of honest brokers of the marketplace. And in that way, our goal is not to alarm people or provide lots of sensational sort of headlines, but really to sit down and make things better, and how do we do that? And, you know, we've talked about the magazine and the information we provide there. We've talked about the policy changes, but there's no question that sitting down with folks in the industry and companies who are trying to understand more, or really who even just have a complaint, they don't believe what we've said. I know we got something from the Grocery Manufacturers of America, a very scathing letter from them after we had done a report on gums. We sat down and wrote them a very, very detailed response as to why it is we did not think that these ingredients had been determined to be safe and why we had concerns about them. And it's something that we do over and over again and is really part of the bread and butter of how we do our work here.
Well, let me ask you one other thing that makes people skeptical and sometimes pessimistic, is that they just assume that whichever side pays the most wins. And so the criticism of, say, people that are involved in government service, there's the popular image that there is a revolving door, that they are paid X amount with the government, but they can make 3X if they go to work for this corporation that they're regulating. How do you address that skepticism?
I tend to agree with the skepticism a little bit. And let me just sort of qualify that by saying that there's many people in the government agencies that truly want to do the right thing. I do think that revolving door, whether it's through the meat industry and USDA, whether it's through other huge industries and the FDA, I do think it raises a question as to who is being served. And if you ask the agencies who they serve, they'll tell you that it's both. They serve the industry and they serve the public. And so in that way, I think it's okay to be a little skeptical, and I think it's really got to be the science at the end of the day that rules.
Well, there's going to be a new administration. There will be someone elected president, and so about this time next year, the jobs are going to be getting filled. Will you be watching that? Will your organization be offering opinions on the kind of people that fill the key jobs in the new government?
We have only on occasion made noise about appointments, really in people that we feel are going to be so detrimental that they really shouldn't at all have a chance to be appointed. That said, our organization tends not to focus on all of the appointments that are made. And I think that in large part has to do with, again, arguing on the basis of the science, not any kind of bias or opinion, but what the science says and what we think they should do. So that won't be our focus, but groups like Food and Water Watch, they definitely point those things out, and there are other groups like Center for Democracy, for example, that are also looking at conflicts of interest, who's been paid by who and who's getting appointed where. And that's really important work. We're aware of that work, but we don't tend to go knee-deep into doing that work ourselves.
Well, I tell you, we could go on and on. I've really appreciated this conversation. But I do want to ask you one more thing about looking ahead. I mean, you've been involved with food systems in lots of different ways, including facilities. And, you know, you've talked about what's, you know, pasture-raised and what isn't, and GMOs and BPA. And I'm just, we don't have time to go into each of these issues in a few minutes that we might have left here, but I do want to ask you, what are a couple of the things on the horizon that we could talk about in the future, but what do you see coming down the road that has your attention? Because if you jump into something, you're going to be taking a period of time for investigation, and you pointed out some considerable expense to kind of look into an issue. What are some of the issues taking shape on the food side that will be getting your attention in the future?
Well, we are looking at, we'll continue to pull on the threads of arsenic, and the FDA just came out with a standard, for example, for infant rice formula. We want to see standards for breakfast cereals, and so we'll be pushing for those things and really pulling on those threads. We're also looking at some other food additives in food. Carrageenan is something that we've been looking closely at, especially in terms of organic and whether it's appropriate for use in organic. But we also have some concerns with the ingredient itself, and we'll be looking further into that. And we continue to sort of watchdog labels out there. And the natural label, there's a comment closing on May 10th next week, in terms of what the FDA should do in terms of defining natural. We expect the USDA to be releasing a proposed rule or some sort of announcement about natural labeling on meat. We want to make sure those things either mean something for consumers, or please just ban the term altogether so it doesn't mislead. And those are some things that are on the horizon for us.
And I suppose in your case, people can buy your magazine and go to your website. And any other suggestions for the people that want to connect with what you're doing?
Sure. There's lots of ways to do that. There's obviously consumerreports.org. There's also our own food site called greenerchoices.org, which will be going under a facelift. You can find detailed ratings evaluations for all the different labels. You can compare labels on beef and chicken, and see how they stack up against different production practices. It's a free site, and there's also a newsletter that we send out every month, and we'll be happy to send one out to you. And just know, for a lot of the reports that we do, if you're really interested in food and want to have the science at your disposal, we've done 50-page reports on beef and shrimp and other issues that you can find online as well and download them, that can really be used in any which way to help you or your organization help create better change as well.
Well, Dr. Urvashi Rangan, I really appreciate your being on Farm to Table Talk. It's been a great conversation this morning, and one that could go on, and I hope you'll come back and visit again sometime.
I hope so too. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to listen regularly on SoundCloud or iTunes to Farm to Table Talk.